Chapter 3. Accept What You Are Capable Of. In 1966, President Lyndon B. Johnson created the Presidential Physical Fitness Test. It consisted of a series of physical challenges determined to assess one's athletic ability and to encourage grade school children to be physically fit. For much of its history, the mile run was a staple of the test. When I ventured down to Howdy Elementary School to watch a group of students tackle 8 laps of a dirt 200-meter track, it was unlike any of the thousands of college and professional races I've watched over the years. When Mrs. Passmore yelled, "Go!" the kids bolted off the line in a dead sprint for the lead. As they made their way past the first lap, reality hit. They had a long way to go. Kids slowed dramatically, transforming from a sprint to a jog. For those in the middle or back of the pack, their transition was even more abrupt, from a run to a walk. While a handful of the kids held on to a consistent slow trot during the middle laps, the rest of the field found themselves alternating between walking and short but quick bursts of running, often triggered by the teacher or a friend cheering them on. Inevitably, as the finish line neared, they all summoned up a final kick, a sprint that rivaled their initial burst of speed off the line. The best way to describe the race was like a yo-yo bouncing back and forth between running and walking. Unlike their younger counterparts, experienced endurance athletes adopt a more optimal, even pacing strategy, staying nice and steady. How do we make that transition, abandoning our sprint-walk strategy in favor of the preferred, more even-paced approach? When it comes to just about any endurance task, regardless of whether it's cycling, swimming, or running, we utilize a simple metric to fine-tune our pacing, the sensation of effort. Current theories suggest that we have a kind of internal map approximating how hard a race should feel at any given moment. Our mind knows that if we are attempting a longer race, like a marathon, the first few miles should feel relatively comfortable. If they feel harder than expected, it's a message telling us to slow down, or else we might be in trouble later. We utilize effort as a kind of internal gas gauge, comparing how quickly our car is burning through fuel versus how far we have left to drive. In the field of exercise science, there's a simple formula that dictates how we utilize effort to govern our pacing and ultimately our performance. Performance equals actual demands divided by expected demands. If the pace feels much more comfortable than you expected, you pick it up. If it feels more challenging than expected, our feeling of pain and fatigue will go up, our inner dialogue will become negative, and we're more likely to slow down. If you reach mile 4 of the marathon and you're already out of breath, you might spiral to a full-blown freakout and drop out. At each point along the way, our brain makes an internal calculation of whether this feels harder or easier than expected. Pain and fatigue are our body's way of nudging us toward a course correction. We can't sustain the pace, so we'd better slow down. If we don't listen, our body will take matters into its own hands, shutting us down to prevent catastrophic failure or damage, like a car that may run out of gas miles before its destination. A tougher runner isn't one who is blind with ambition or confidence, but one who can accurately assess the demands and the situation. The magic is in aligning actual and expected demands. When our assessment of our capabilities is out of sync with the demands, we get the school children version of performance. Starting a project with reckless confidence, only to look up and realize the work it entails. When such a mismatch exists, we're more likely to spiral toward doubts and insecurities, and to ultimately abandon our pursuit. When actual and expected demands align, we're able to pace to perfection, or outside of the athletic realm, perform up to our current capabilities. It's why experienced writers don't go into their first draft expecting perfection. They understand it's going to be messy, and often not that good. Contrary to old-school toughness wisdom, a touch of realistic doubt keeps us on track and makes it more likely that we will persist. Toughness is about embracing the reality of where we are and what we have to do. Not deluding ourselves, filling ourselves with a false confidence, or living in denial. All of that simply sends us sprinting off the line, only to slow to a walk once reality hits. Being tough begins long before we enter the arena or walk on stage. It starts with our expectations. The threat of death. Climbing a ladder to reach the roof of your home isn't the most dangerous endeavor. A well-made ladder is sturdy and durable, equipped with steps to make the short climb to the top as uneventful and steady as possible. Despite the relative safety of such a trek, the first time we get beyond the bottom few steps, a wave of unease rushes through our body. Maybe even a tinge of fear and thoughts of, what if I fall, pop into our mind. If we look down as we near the top steps, these feelings magnify. We might rationalize our experience, believing that a fall is unlikely. And even if we did misstep and plummet to the ground, we'd likely be bruised but survive. As we come to terms with our role of handyman and adjust to climbing ladders, the fears and feelings dissipate. The anxiety and fear slowly fade. We feel safe. Now, imagine instead of looking down from 10 feet and standing on a secure metal step, you peer down to the ground that you can barely see thousands of feet below. Instead of a secure step, you're on a rock face with nearly zero outcroppings or ledges. Feet and arms perched on minor deviations of the rock surface, holding on to parts of the rock that may jut out from the surface by a few millimeters at best. You aren't grasping onto a ledge with the entirety of your hands. It's the very tips of your fingers that secure you to the granite wall's surface. And unlike any rational human being when attempting to climb a vertical wall, there is no safety net. No ropes to anchor you to the side of the wall, to protect you from falling to your death in the case of a misplaced finger or foot. Just you, alone on the wall. Welcome to the world of free soloing. In June 2017, climber Alex Honnold faced such a challenge, climbing the face of El Capitan, a 3,000-foot vertical granite monolith in Yosemite National Park. He did so without a rope or safety harness, with a narrow grip of his hands and feet keeping him from falling to his death. To tackle such an endeavor, mastery of climbing is a given. But how does someone deal with the fear, anxiety, and pressure of such an undertaking? When most of us stare down from the third-story balcony of our hotel room and experience fear from leaning over the edge, how is Honnold able to master his emotions and inner dialogue to handle the challenge? His nickname, No Big Deal, provides a clue. Neuroscientist Jane Joseph took a peek inside Honnold's brain to see if she could find an answer. While lying in an fMRI machine to scan blood flow in his brain, Honnold watched a series of disturbing images flash in front of his eyes. Think disfigured bloody corpses or a toilet filled with feces. Pictures designed to make just about anyone cringe. Even if we have no visceral experience, for even the strongest among us, our brain will betray us with an internal sign of provocation. An almond-shaped part of our brain called the amygdala should light up. The amygdala has many functions. Primary among them is to detect and respond to threats. When disgusting or threatening pictures, like those shown to Honnold, trigger the amygdala, a cascade of events is unleashed that eventually result in a slew of hormones released and nervous system activity. We call this a stress response. In a conversation captured in the magazine Nautilus, Honnold asked whether or not the images of children burning counted as stress. Despite being reassured by Joseph that such images routinely elicit some sort of emotional arousal, even in rock climbers and adrenaline junkies, Honnold quipped, "Because I can't say for sure, but I was like, whatever." And as Joseph would later see, Honnold wasn't putting on an act. His brain echoed his experience. There were no flashes of color to indicate activity in the brain's threat and fear-sensing areas, just gray. Honnold's amygdala didn't react to a single disturbing image, not a blip of activity. Honnold's secret weapon might be that his emotional reactivity is monk-like. When the rest of us are smashing the panic button, heading toward a freakout, Honnold's mind is enjoying the scenery, quietly thinking, there's no threat here. Honnold isn't superhuman. Shortly into his first attempt to climb El Capitan, Honnold mused, "This sucks. I don't want to be here. I'm over it." He pulled the plug, explaining, "I don't know if I can try with everybody watching. It's too scary." It's not that Honnold never experiences threats, that his amygdala never lights up. It does so when he needs it to. That day, fear rang out, and he listened, pulling the plug before disaster struck. He'd wait to reach his goal another day. Through a bit of luck, the right genes, and countless hours of mental and physical rehearsal, Honnold has fine-tuned his threat-detecting machinery to be triggered when something is truly off. Not when pictures pop up on a computer screen, but when he can't actually complete the task he sets out to. Our body's alarm system is malleable. We don't have to be monk-like and turn the knobs to adjust our sensitivity. We just have to get better at predicting. Research consistently shows that tougher individuals are able to perceive stressful situations as challenges instead of threats. A challenge is something that's difficult but manageable. On the other hand, a threat is something we're just trying to survive, to get through. This difference in appraisals isn't because of an unshakable confidence or because tougher individuals downplay the difficulty. Rather, those who can see situations as a challenge developed the ability to quickly and accurately assess the situation and their ability to cope with it. An honest appraisal is all about giving your mind better data to predict with. Like an epidemiologist predicting the public's response to a novel virus, a better appraisal allows us to unleash the response we need for that situation and moment. Appraising the world around us. Whenever we face a new or stressful situation, our body does its best to prepare for what's to come. But we don't wait to see exactly what that noise in the brush is, or whether or not our job is dependent on the boardroom presentation. Our body cheats. Instead of waiting to see whether a task is hazardous, our brain makes its best guess about what we need to survive or thrive. It's the reason you feel nerves or a racing heart well before you step onto a stage. It's why, while waiting for the plane to reach the right altitude to jump out, novice skydivers are filled with dread, while veteran skydivers are excited. Inside their bodies, the novices are secreting cortisol, while the veterans have more adrenaline. Same event, yet the body releases different hormones to prepare for what's to come. Whether it's climbing a ladder or a mountain, our biological response and the sensations that come with it are guided not only by the actual experience, but by our expectations. How we see the world shapes how we respond to it. Before we step on stage or up to the batter's box, our body has already entered a performance state. The rush of adrenaline we feel is to prepare us for jumping out of a plane or stepping up to the starting line. And as that saying hints at, the experience is caused by the internal milieu of nervous system activation and hormonal release. Our body uses these chemical reactions to prepare for whatever we're going to face. A stress response prepares us for action. We tend to think of it as a binary choice, fight or flight. But the reality is, we have a slew of different ways to prepare for whatever is in front of us. It's the combination of hormones and nervous system activity that pushes us toward responding in a certain way. Adrenaline surges to prepare us for rapid movement. Simultaneously, the hormone oxytocin pushes us toward a group effort to get through the danger, and cortisol liberates vital fuel sources in our cells to prepare our muscles and minds to work over the next few hours. With each shift in the amount or type of ingredient in the recipe, we change everything from the texture to the flavor. Some responses prepare the muscles for actions. Others open up or slow down the blood flow, while some marshal the immune system to prepare for potential damage or injury. It's as if our body has its own 911 system, deciding whether to send an ambulance, police officers, firefighters, a social worker, or the SWAT team. How does it know which one to send? It's our evaluation of the situation and ourself that largely determines which way we'll go. Protect or attack it head on. Are we like the expert marathoners who are able to match expected effort at any given moment during a race with their actual experience? Or are we like the grade school kids who misjudge how difficult running a mile will be? Does our appraisal of our skills match our appraisal of the demands of the situation? This mismatch between situational demands and our capacity to cope doesn't just determine running performance. It determines what kind of response to stress we'll have. When we see a stressful situation as something that could cause physical or psychological harm, we're more likely to experience a threat response, a rush of cortisol, and a shift toward defending and protecting. Our body unleashes a threat response when we face a demand that we aren't quite equipped to handle. Like our novice skydivers, we're just trying to survive. How do we make it out of this situation with our physical and psychological health intact? We take fewer risks, playing to not lose instead of playing to win. On the other hand, if we see the stressor as an opportunity for growth or gain, as something that is difficult but that we can handle, we're more likely to experience a challenge response. Instead of relying mostly on cortisol, our body releases more testosterone and adrenaline. We shift toward figuring out how to win the game, how to accomplish our goal. It's not that challenge or threat responses are good or bad. They each have a specific purpose. If we encounter a bear protecting its cubs on a trail, we want a threat response, freezing, assessing the situation, and then calmly backing away. But when we're trying to perform at our best, seeing the world through the lens of a threat isn't what we need. We want to see the task as a challenge. How we appraise ourselves and the situation shifts which way we go. If expectations partially determine what we feel, think, and do, is it best to downplay the difficulty? To tell ourselves that the task won't be that hard or painful? When our expected effort is different from the actual effort, our brain course corrects. The degree of mismatch determines the reaction. If there's a large mismatch between expectations and reality, our brain overcorrects. If we went into a test thinking it would be a cakewalk, at the first sign of difficulty, it's as if the brain goes, "Hey, what is this? This isn't supposed to be hard." As a result, instead of figuring a way through the discomfort, we shut down. We go into full protective mode. We freeze. Is it better to prepare for the worst? Go in with the anticipation that this race, presentation, or project will be the most difficult and demanding task that we've ever faced? In our racing scenario, if we expect an immense challenge, and it's easier than expected, we'll pick up the pace and perform better. Wrong. If our expectations swing too far in the other direction, our brain goes into what I call what's the point mode. The task will be so far outside of our capabilities that there's no point in using our full reserve to take on the challenge. We're doomed before we start. Our ability to be tough and handle adversity starts well before we even encounter any difficulty. It starts with embracing the reality of the situation and what you're capable of. Toughness maxim. Our appraisal of a situation as a threat or as a challenge depends on the perceived demands of that stressor versus our perceived abilities to handle them. Do we have the resources to handle the demands? Facing reality. It's easy to be tough when you know you can handle the situation. The true test comes when you can't. A former athlete of mine, Drevin Anderson Ka'apa, relayed to me about his experiences. Drevin was a 3-time conference champion in college who also represented his country at the World University Games. But Drevin didn't just win races. He figured out ways to get the most out of his body, regardless of the situation. On the University of Houston track team, he became a sort of living legend, with stories about his heroics being passed down to every incoming class of students. There was the time after he'd won his individual race at a championship that he then volunteered to run the 4x400, an event he had not run in his entire collegiate career. Not only was it unfamiliar, but with the team scores being a near-dead heat, Whoever won the relay captured the team title. Despite the pressure of having to win, he walked up to two of the coaches, who happened to be track and field legends Carl Lewis and Leroy Burrell, and declared, "I'll run it, and I'll run anchor," putting himself up against some of the fastest runners in college track. Of course, he sealed the victory, roaring back in the last 50 meters to claim the team title. But it wasn't just his track accolades that set Drevin apart. During his college career, he not only competed at an elite level, but he also obtained a master's degree and was part of ROTC. Upon graduation, he went from representing his country on the track to serving it in the military. When it comes to toughness, there are very few people I've encountered who epitomize the word. Drevin is one of them. As we sat at my kitchen table in the fall of 2018 and discussed toughness, he continued with his observations from the athletic and military world. Everyone wears a mask. We carry around a facade, projecting an outer image of who we want to be. But when you are under stress, that fades away, and you're left with what's underneath. Stress exposes you. When I asked Drevin to explain what he meant, he outlined two distinct masks he'd observed during his athletic and military days. First, there was the individual who looked the part, projecting bravado and self-assurance. They were the athlete who talked big, while downplaying the difficulty of the task at hand. "This will be a piece of cake," they'd say pregame. Yet, the moment something went awry, all that self-assurance faded away. They became timid, unsure of their abilities, and would fall back when challenged during the most difficult part of the race. The second version initially appears similar. They, too, have a sense of confidence, exuding a certainty that they'll be able to handle what's thrown at them. But standing on the starting line, they weren't downplaying what was to come, but were clear-eyed on the difficulty of the task at hand. One example stood out. When dropped off in the middle of the woods as part of survival training, with minimal supplies and working off extreme sleep deprivation, Drevin and his companions were forced to put their skills to the test. As energy levels dissipate, your world narrows to focus on satisfying your basic needs: food, water, and sleep. Not much else matters. It's easy to forget the group and focus on yourself. Drevin found himself watching a number of his companions, who days earlier were team-focused and extremely confident of their abilities, succumb to the stress of survival. These individuals took more than their share of limited rations or snuck a few extra minutes of sleep when they were supposed to relieve their colleague of watch duty. The rest of the group maintained their discipline, keeping their cognitive wits and team focus despite the situation. Under normal conditions, toughness is easy. Under extreme duress, not so much. We default to choosing the easy path. When I asked Drevin what the difference was in individuals who were able to keep their cool, he replied, "When there's a difference between what you project and what you are capable of, it all crumbles under stressful situations. If, on the other hand, you're honest with yourself and acknowledge what your strengths and weaknesses are, what you're capable of, and what might scare you, then you can come to terms with what you're facing and deal with it. The you walking the streets and the you stranded in a jungle aren't that much different. So you're able to assess the situation with clear eyes and expectations instead of trying to live up to some false standard." It was the same thing in track. The ones who thought they had to bring 110% to a race inevitably fell apart. The ones who lined up on the starting line and thought, "This is going to be easy," or "This is going to be extremely hard," didn't perform up to standard. They were living in an altered reality. The ones who said, "Here's what I'm capable of. Here's what the race demands. I'm going to execute based on those two things." Those are the ones who consistently perform. Drevin's experience isn't unique. It's backed by scientific research. At the turn of the 21st century, a group of scientists analyzed soldiers across the military branches as they went through the same type of survival school that Drevin experienced. They noticed the same phenomenon. While nearly everyone experienced high levels of stress, one group seemed to zone out and become almost detached from the experience, while another was able to largely maintain a clear, level head and perform up to their potential. Both groups were managing stress in a different way, yet the ones who focused on the reality of the situation were better at handling various elements of the mission. These more robust soldiers appraised the upcoming task as a challenge instead of a threat. In concluding their work, the group of researchers summarized their findings that the more robust individuals are more accurate in descriptions of what they encountered during stress. They were facing reality. Toughness maxim: embrace reality. Accurate appraisal of demands plus accurate appraisal of our abilities. Setting your mind on reality. A key component of real toughness is acknowledging when something is hard, not pretending it isn't. An honest appraisal of ourself and the situation allows us to have a productive response to stress. It can shift whether our body is pushed toward fear or excitement, challenge or threat, and in turn, whether we'll take a risk, shy away, or be able to access our full potential. Embracing reality isn't about sitting around and thinking about what you are capable of and whatever challenges you are about to take on. There are research-backed strategies that we can use to fine-tune our mind, to nudge us toward an accurate appraisal, and even more so toward a productive stress response that prepares us for action. 1. Set appropriate goals. We're often told to shoot for the moon or dream big when it comes to setting goals, but research points to the opposite conclusion. Set goals that are just beyond our current capabilities. If there's too large of a mismatch between our abilities and our goal, our motivation decreases. It's as if our brain shrugs its shoulders and says, "What's the point? We aren't going to win anyway." Whenever we set our expectations too high, we're more likely to enter the freak-out stage of our toughness pattern. Instead of going big, set just manageable challenges. 2. Set authentic goals. In a series of studies in the Netherlands, psychologists sought to understand why some individuals are able to make progress and reach their goals, while others continually fall short. Over 3 studies, researchers found that better goal authenticity contributed to better goal achievement. When people chose goals that reflected their true selves, not their public selves, they were more likely to follow through. Those who failed often chose goals that were imposed on them by a parent, coach, or society in general. For those who were successful, goals came from within, reflecting who they were and what they cared about. A high degree of self-knowledge is what allowed these individuals to see clearly. Seeing reality doesn't just mean understanding what you're capable of and what the actual task demands are. It means taking the time to understand who you are and what matters to you. Whether through introspection, journaling, or conversations with close friends and family, do the hard work to ask what matters and why it does. Tough people are self-aware, and they get there by embracing reality and understanding who they are. 3. Define judgments and expectations. If we all took the viewpoint of Ricky Bobby from the movie Talladega Nights that, if you aren't first, you're last, we would be in trouble. What happens when we set an audacious goal and quickly realize we can't hit it? When we don't think we have a shot, whether it's in a race or in class, our brain shuts us down. Our mind jumps into protection mode, thinking, "Well, we aren't going to win, so why waste any energy trying?" We are unintentionally killing our drive if we define success and failure in such a narrow way. I've witnessed far too many people harm their motivation and their performance by defining success in the wrong way. They'll focus solely on outcomes, neglecting to realize that what place they finish in or what their grade is on a presentation is largely out of their control. Shifting the focus toward process-oriented goals, such as the effort you can put forth, helps remedy these situations. It also provides vital feedback that allows you to grow in the future. When you judge yourself solely by what place you came across the finish line, It provides zero actionable information on how to improve in the future. Judging yourself by how much effort you gave, or whether you executed your plan, offers a roadmap for what can be worked on during the next go-round. 4. Course correct for stress. A group of French researchers from the University of Nantes wanted to see how stress affected individuals' judgment of what they were capable of. They chose a simple task: estimating how high of a bar one could step over. The trick was that participants had to make their guess after being kept awake in a lab for 24 hours straight. Sleep deprivation does a number on the brain, inducing stress and fatigue. Regardless of the actual height they could navigate in a normal state, participants severely underestimated the height they could step over when in a sleep-deprived state. Stress alters our judgment of what we're capable of. In another study, researchers found that those in chronic pain tend to overestimate the distance to walk to a target. These findings led sports psychologist Thibaut Deschamps to state, "Individuals perceive the environment in terms of the costs of acting within it." In another study, researchers asked individuals standing at the bottom of a hill to guess how steep the hill was. The overwhelming majority greatly overestimated the steepness, guessing it was a 20, 25, or even 30-degree grade hill. In reality, the hill had a 5% grade. There was one group of students who were accurate: the cross-country team. If we have the capability to run up the hill without too much undue stress, we see the steepness for what it is. If we don't, it looks overwhelming. In an interesting twist, when researchers took those runners and made them go out for a long run and then come back and judge the slant of the hill, their hill judging expertise disappeared. In a state of fatigue, they started overestimating the slope to a much greater degree. Fatigue had shifted their capabilities, and with them, their perception abilities. When we flip into a threat state, a freeze reaction, or a full-blown freakout, the normal often seems unattainable. We tend to overcompensate, greatly diminishing what we're capable of. Part of having an accurate appraisal is course-correcting. If you feel tired, fatigued, or anxious, you can learn how to navigate that. But knowing that you might sell yourself short gives you the power to do something about it and to readjust as stress or fatigue mounts. 5. Prime your mind. In 2018, a group of researchers out of University College London wanted to see how stress impacts the way we treat information. In the study, they looked at how on-duty firefighters and students who were about to step on stage to give a speech handled being informed of either good or bad news. For example, being told your chance of getting in a car crash or suffering serious injury in a fire was much higher than the subjects thought. When relaxed, participants tended to ignore the bad news and embrace the good. Hearing that there was a greater chance to suffer some negative consequence didn't impact their behavior or mood. But under stress, as lead researcher Tali Sharet summarized, they became hypervigilant to any bad news we gave them, even when it had nothing to do with their job, such as learning that the likelihood of card fraud was higher than they'd thought, and altered their beliefs in response. Stress shifts us toward a negative bias, priming us to search out and recognize danger or threats in the environment. This is a great evolutionary survival mechanism, but it can hamper our performance when we aren't really in danger. To combat this quirk of evolution, prime your mind to search for opportunities, not threats. In Peak Performance, I outlined research that shows that when athletes warm up by doing what they like, they alter their hormonal state in a positive manner. The same phenomenon applies to artists and executives. The closer you are to a performance, the more you want to prime with what you're good at. Reviewing mistakes, working on weaknesses, telling yourself that you can't hit the slider, so watch for it, backfires when you're on deck. Those are items you work on far before it's time to step into the batter's box. True toughness begins long before we reach the playing field or the conference table. It starts with how we assess the situation and our capabilities. Our expectations set the stage for our biological reaction, Our assessment can affect every step along the toughness chain, biasing us to feel more pain and leading to a premature freakout. Before we get to the point where we need to bounce back off the turf after a brutal tackle, we need the right frame of mind. Our biology is already primed and biasing us in a particular direction before facing any sort of challenge. What direction we end up going is largely up to how we see ourselves and the world around us.